This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, September 17th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Election Day is only weeks away. Throughout this very long campaign season, Democrats and Republicans have portrayed the contest as an existential struggle, with the future of the country and even the world hinging on who wins the White House. At a campaign stop in Wilmington, Delaware this week, Joe Biden had this to say.
If you give a climate arsonist 4 more years in the White House, why would anyone be surprised if we have more America ablaze? If you give a climate denier 4 more years in the White House, why would anyone be surprised when more of America is underwater? We need a president who respects science, who understands that the damage from climate change is already here. And unless we take urgent action, we'll soon be more catastrophic.
But some argue that the presidency might not be the most important issue in November. Across the country, voters will also elect governors and state legislators. Those elections lack the drama and enormous budgets of the presidential race, but state officials have a more direct effect on the lives of their constituents. They write labor law, determine access to health care, handle the response to the COVID-19 pandemic, and determine how and when voters vote. Daniel Squadron, a former New York State senator, is the co-founder of Future Now, an organization that mobilizes support and raises funds for progressive candidates in state elections. They helped to flip the legislatures of Maine and New Hampshire in the 2018 midterms, and last fall played a role in turning Virginia's state house blue. He joins me to discuss what the 2020 election looks like from his perspective. Daniel, it's great to have you back.
Thank you for having me. Great to talk to you.
You joined us last year to talk about your work with Future Now, which, as I recall, you founded shortly after Trump was inaugurated. In recent months, voters have been bombarded by the two presidential campaigns with requests for donations, and it seems to have been working pretty well for Biden. In August, his campaign and his joint committee brought in $365 million. So remind us why Future Now thinks it's more important to be giving money to state-level candidates.
Well, if you just look at the dollar amounts, and first of all, we do think that Joe Biden beating Donald Trump is an important thing, and certainly understand why folks are engaged and are glad to see that the support is flipping in the way that you described. The thing that's critical to remember is that dollars just go farther in state legislative elections in terms of the impact you can have than anywhere else. You know, you talk about the presidential race, it's even true of congressional races, where the most expensive ones cost well north of $10 million. That's the kind of budget for an entire state to flip. And of course, when you flip an entire state, you change the balance of power in that state. When it comes to drawing congressional maps, when it comes to voting laws that have a big impact on the presidency, when it comes to laws that govern the Electoral College, and as you point out, when it comes to the policies that really impact people, COVID is costing lives and jobs. Those are largely state policies that are going to be able to impact that effectively. And incompetence and corruption has devastating effects.
So for this election, you're hoping to flip the legislatures, you say, of 8 states and then preserve Democratic majorities in 3. Could you tell us about those efforts?
Sure. So, you know, the 8 states where we think it's possible to flip the legislatures include some of those same states that everyone's talking about all the time because they're on the presidential map: Michigan, Arizona, North Carolina, Florida, New Hampshire. But then in addition, there's talk about a state like Texas, where actually in the legislature, there's a real opportunity. That state has changed enormously, and people are fed up with the kinds of impact they've seen from Trump Republicans.
Including their governor.
Exactly right. Well, it's an interesting thing that we're seeing is you know, when folks are really faced with the consequences of massive incompetence and corruption and lies in the face of both the COVID health crisis and economic crisis, you see them start to say, enough is enough. It's no longer about a bunch of rallies and slogans. It becomes about people's lives, and that changes support. We're also trying to flip a couple of smaller states, the sorts of states that because of the Electoral College get ignored, states like Montana and Iowa, and even Kansas, we're flipping the legislatures hard. We've got a great Democratic governor down there and a Republican supermajority that is able to undermine her good work.
And are you finding that there's a lot of energy there? What kinds of responses are you getting?
The response level for state legislative work this year is unlike anything I've seen. The problem is the baseline level of engagement is so unacceptable that we're still not where we need to be.
So because so many of us know so much more about the presidential campaigns and the big U.S. Senate challenges like Susan Collins in Maine and to Martha McSally in Arizona, we have been paying less close attention to contested state elections, maybe zero in on one particular state that others are watching closely on the national level, like, say, Pennsylvania and what you guys are doing there.
So in Pennsylvania, in both the House and the Senate, you have Republican majorities, you have a Democratic governor, and you have a whole lot of districts in the House and a smaller but enough districts in the Senate that really could flip this year. It's an interesting thing. You have actually something like 41 Republicans holding seats that were won by the Democratic governor, Wolf, in Pennsylvania. And you have candidates running like Anton Andrew, who's a gun safety advocate and a clean water advocate. I love when folks like this run because he's already, through his advocacy and partnership, successfully gotten bills passed and now wants to come into the system as a representative of constituents. And in the Pennsylvania Senate is important to note because, I think a year ago, a lot of folks said that it would be really hard to flip both chambers. And it has become more likely, we believe, because you've got great candidates and great campaigns. And so both of those chambers really are on the table. And that would be a flip in Pennsylvania in a really important way, not least because as a presidential swing state, Pennsylvania is a state where the presidential electors are going to matter. And it has been suggested that there might be some attempt to steal the Electoral College through state legislators' unique ability to choose the manner of selecting presidential electors. Well, in Pennsylvania, whoever we elect in November is going to come into office in time to prevent that theft from happening.
We keep hearing, the rest of us keep hearing about how few swing voters there actually are, but then we also hear how important it is to go after them. Just this morning, the Times had a story about Democrats' frustration with Biden for not campaigning more frequently in states like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, for that matter. So your organization picks these state candidates to endorse, and then you encourage enthusiastic voters to form these local groups to help their fundraising efforts. It's easy to see how you mobilize people who are already interested in progressive politics, but do you also go after those elusive, undecided voters?
We think that going after voters is really the candidates' job. They're the best messengers of who they are. They're the ones who, when the doors close, are going to have to make decisions in terms of their own values and their constituents' values. But there's no question that what we do is we go after districts where you need these undecided voters. It's an interesting thing because one of the interesting things that you see in state legislative races that sort of gets us past this poisonous moment we're in is because of the ability to build individual relationships, it's more possible to convince someone who might have sort of a strong national view of the two parties and the brands associated with them that someone of goodwill with their best interests at heart is worth voting for, even in the other party. A lot of those sort of fixed realities of people's opinion of the parties can be changed if they have an individual connection to the person running for office, which to my mind is sort of an inspiring path forward on a politics that's become so poisonously divided.
Yeah, it really is. I was also struck by something on your website, which said that vote switching was the key to the blue wave of 2018. And I think you guys say that 89% of the Democratic margin came from people who switched from voting Republican or third party in prior elections to voting Democratic.
And that speaks to the fact that you really can switch voters. You do need to turn out more and engage more voters. And you need to figure out how to switch voters. It's a really interesting insight. You actually see shifts among, you know, those rural white voters who are sort of in the popular imagination, the ultimate Trump voter. You actually see shifts in those voters between 2016 and 2018 away from Trump. He still won a majority of those voters, but a smaller majority. And this balance between understanding some of these broader shifts, right? College-educated suburbanites, overwhelmingly white college-educated suburbanites, have shifted from Trump to Biden. We've had demographic shifts with more younger voters, more Latinx voters. Those things are true writ large. It's also true that every voter is an individual and that it's not about winning 51% of some demographic slice. It's about winning as many total votes as possible. And so going after these margins, meaning individuals, even in demographically more challenging groups, is worth doing. It's the right thing to do. And it's a great way to pick up votes. But I think one lesson that we always try to share with the candidates we're working with is don't fall into that false choice between convincing folks, the so-called swing voter, and mobilizing folks, your voters in your base who might or might not turn out. This debate is one that's very popular in the media. Which things should we be doing?
Yes.
And of course, the answer is yes. We need to be doing both.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So many Democrats are terrified that this election is going to be a repeat of 2016, and everyone was caught flat-footed thanks to inaccurate polls in 2016. Do you rely on polls now, and is there any sense that they're more accurate? Is there a reason for us to be watching these day to day?
Well, I'd say this to anyone who's looking at polls to decide whether to vote. We are in politics. I've been in politics for my career. I have never taken a single action based exclusively on a poll. So whatever the polls show, you have to go vote because there's going to be this attempt to make it look closer and because polls are often wrong. Polls have real value over time in showing you the direction of things. And so we certainly look at polls and research that way as part of an overall picture of what's happening. Polls are really a stand-in for a sporting event type description of what's happening. But it's not a sporting event, and the polls don't take you to the last 2 minutes, which is then the vote count. And I think folks think they do. We're ahead, but they're coming back. No one's ahead until any votes get cast. Mm-hmm. And we don't know who's ahead until any votes get counted. What we know from polls is where things are trending in different places, when it makes sense as part of everything else we know.
And we do know now that Trump did as well as he did in 2016 because of his support among non-college educated white voters. Do you think that's likely to be the case again?
Well, it's an interesting question. If the question is, will a majority of non-college educated white voters or any other demographic slice that we create vote for Trump or Biden? I think that's actually a much simpler question. What percentage and what margin does that create as you then look at all the voters who are not in the demographic slice is the question. This is why our research director, Aaron Kleiman's research is so important. Decreasing the margin, even if you're still quote unquote losing a group of voters in a geography or a demography, can be a victory because it's not about being first across the line with a demographic slice. It's about building an overall coalition that gets you more votes in a state legislative context and gets you more electoral votes in a presidential context.
I see. So how have COVID-19 and the protests against police brutality changed your organization's approach to what you do on the state level?
The superpower for legislative candidates normally is door knocking. Right? That's how they can go and have those in-person conversations that can change the total physics of a campaign. That, of course, is a lot more difficult. So there is certainly a shift to trying to do some of these things, both virtually, figuring out how to build concentric circles of personal networks to start to reach people outside your original bubble, right? So get activated folks in your district who are willing to volunteer for you and activate their networks using social media and their other connections for good.
But presumably the personal connections are still, you know, the most important way to go.
Well, what you can do is you can get concentric circles of personal connections, right? So you can still get the candidate on a Zoom with folks who they wouldn't otherwise have met because they're not political party activists by engaging that kind of inner ring to engage outer rings.
But does that have the same effect as being in the same room with someone? It couldn't possibly.
We don't know for sure. And we know that, for example, phone calls don't have the same effect as being in the same room with people. Being on a Zoom is an untested question. You know, I don't know how your eyes feel after all day on the Zoom, but
not
I
good.
Certainly feel like I've been trapped in front of my computer. I also do feel like I've connected with, you know, people I work with or whatever else it is. Not in a way that's as fulfilling, but in a way that's certainly credible and meaningful. There are other things, though, that this has actually liberated folks to do. You know, one of the things that's really hard about campaigning is you really need to put a stop to all the other things you care about because you just, in the normal context, have to go meet voters all the time. Mm-hmm. Well, now, because that's not an option, there are candidates who have been able to, in the wake of the hurricane, go and actually help with recovery efforts in the community as a part of community service and engagement. That's the sort of thing that candidates would love to do in the normal context. And you can't because you just need to be campaigning all the time. So there are certain ways in which the engagement can be deeper and fuller. It is also hard to have in-person contact with as many folks, which does mean that dollars for the campaigns mean more. Rather than shoe polish being the number one cost, which is what it is for a candidate to door knock, the cost is getting time on people's digital applications, getting mail, getting TV. So dollars do matter more than they otherwise would.
If you see the kinds of electoral gains you're hoping for this year, how might the 2024 election look different from 2020?
Oh, that's such a great question. In every way. Changing power in state legislatures determines who will win in Congress, who will win the presidency, and what kind of country we are living in. So there will be three things that change. One, more states will have fair maps drawn so that rather than politicians determining who gets elected, voters will. Two, more states will have voting laws that encourage and support people's voting rather than undermining it and standing in its way. And three, most importantly, more people will have lived in places where the government has a chance to show that they can have a positive impact in people's lives. Rather than massive failures that cost lives in COVID and make everyone more discouraged, they may have governments that help with testing and tracing to save lives and get us back to normal more quickly. Rather than job losses that drive people into homelessness and hunger, you might have small business investment and job support that create more good jobs. Rather than schools that seem to be too often avoiding the underlying problems that make teaching so hard in person, much less remotely, you might have schools that are actually the centers of their communities and are creating more equity and opportunity, even just in the next 2 to 4 years. It's that dramatic. And whatever the U.S. Senate and the president and the House do on climate change, you might have a majority of the American economy designed around creating new green jobs and getting us to zero new climate emissions so that we've got a fighting chance against that crisis.
Well, best of luck. And thanks so much for joining me again, Daniel.
Thank you. Great talking to you.
Daniel Squadron is the co-founder and executive director of Future Now. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.